Speciale Venezia. Ilaria Vanni, lettrice dell'Institute of International Studies dell'University of Technology di Sydney, ha intervistato Simon Rees, commissario del padiglione lituano e curatore del Center for Contemporary Art di Vilnius. Insieme hanno parlato di Villa Lituania, il progetto presentato alla Biennale di Venezia dagli artisti Nomeda e Gediminas Urbonas, del valore simbolico della Pigeon Race, della frammentazione sociale post-sovietica in Lituania, della mancanza di spazi pubblici, del ruolo dell'arte e del linguaggio artistico nella costruzione dell'identità nazionale. L'intervista è in inglese.
Radio Papesse è un progetto di Ilaria Gadens, Carola Haupt e Cristiano Maggi.
Can we start maybe with the history of the project? How did it come about?
In 2006, when the call for proposals for Venice started coming up, I, as curator, developed the idea of Villa Lituania as a symbol. It's a story I'd happened upon in some research, because I've been doing a lot of research about post-Soviet space, and had been involved as a writer in the Save Cinema Litova project, the protest archive, which I was very fascinated with, and went to the artists and said, look, I've got an idea for the Venice Biennale, which would be Italian context specific, which I thought would be good. And I know of connections between the Communist Party of Italy and Russia and Lithuanian emigres through a period, because my partner's father, who's a scholar of classics, had been allowed to spend a lot of time in Rome in the 60s, 70s and 80s. So I came to them and said, Villa Lituania as a symbol. And they said, we're so busy with Guangzhou and other things, write a proposal. If it wins, then we'll think about it, which is what happened. And half a year went by and they came back to me and said, they had been doing research by way of coincidence and came across this ambit about the pigeons, to which I said, fantastic, because I knew the history of Picasso's international symbol of peace, the dove, which had actually been commissioned by Stalin. And it was the official symbol of the Stalin Peace Prize, which during the 60s, or during 56, Hungarian artists started writing to Picasso to try and ask him to renounce his Communist Party membership because of what happened there, and he refused. He never renounced it, even after the release of Gulag Archipelago, you know, Solzhenitsyn. So I was immediately fascinated, though I knew nothing about pigeons materially, and then they started a complete articulation of this idea thereafter. And so what you see in the exhibition, despite my saying the words Villa Lituania, future of politics, future of Marxism, Italy, Rome, Italy, Russia, Lithuania. Everything else you see is an articulation of this symbolic idea of theirs, which relates quite strongly to their existing practice.
And is pigeon race a cultural practice in Lithuania?
Funnily enough, Gediminas had become reacquainted with a childhood friend of his in the last couple of years, who is a major pigeon racing figure, so that somehow Gediminas had become socially engaged in some strange way with his name's Vladimir Abramovich Gorlov, with Vladi Gorlov in this passion. And he saw a similar sort of passion for pigeons as other people show for things like art. And Gediminas and Nomeda have always been fascinated by bringing different groups together within their practice. So this was art fanciers meeting pigeon fanciers. Because, of course, if you look at art as a truly social phenomena, you shouldn't exclude anybody from its reception, which it tends to do. So why not bring art fanciers and pigeon fanciers together in what seems to be an unlikely combination? And, of course, the pigeon fanciers became completely entranced by the idea that their birds could do something more than just race for money, or that their birds could become a national symbolic and could become part of a national cultural, you know, event. So they became, you know, really enthusiastic. And in fact, everybody has donated birds and time and expertise for free, of course, because this, you know, is something they wanted to be involved in. And they've come to understand also that this contemporary art stuff can actually be kind of interesting and important and valuable and to have something to say.
About bringing different groups together to the art practice, I'm quite interested in processes. So it seems to me that in the different components of the installations, there are a number of different people that contributed in different ways. And especially if I look at the protest archive. But also in the different videos. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how this relational process is built and what does it do apart from creating, you know, the end result, which is the art.
Importantly, I think their work comes out of the early 90s when Lithuania first got independence. And there was a generational break between the traditional Sovietic art and new society. And it was the first time that new technology was available as well. And of course, the Lithuanian language is only spoken by 4 million people. So that translations into Lithuanian take a very long time. So, you know, Walter Benjamin has just been translated this year. Che Guevara's diaries have just been, you know, the Andy Warhol diaries were translated last year. So that the internet became a very important tool for people researching that beyond which they could get ready access to. And so Nemeda and Gediminas started using the internet as a way of communicating with the outside world, connecting to international communities, and then drawing an international community to them. So that aspect of their practice started from as early as 1991, and they founded the first artist-run initiative in Lithuania in 92 called Utempus, and they took over the cultural house of railway workers as their exhibition space. So they've got a 15-year track record with working in this way. And what happened somehow within Lithuania is that public space went from state-controlled or totalitarian to monopolistic space without ever a passage of the civic or the democratic in between. Of course, some big neoliberal government developed hand-in-hand with corporations. So what the Protest Lab was about was not necessarily just saving the cinema, but making a space, a built space, where different sorts of social groups could gather. So it wasn't just people interested to save the cinema. Classically, in any Western city, political organizations of all types take their meetings in teachers' houses, union buildings, pubs associated with students. You know, it's close to teachers, nurses, universities, trade unions. Of course, as trade unions have been dismantled, all their property has been sold. That space has disappeared. Student pubs no longer really exist in the way that nurses' houses don't, you know, teachers' houses don't exist in the same way, because they often now belong to parts of town that were outside and were poor, so there was big space available, they get gentrified, the space disappears.
This is very interesting, and it further relates to Venice.
Yeah.
There is nearby here, actually. Not Rifondazione. There is a social center, which is an occupied building in Calamorion.
Yeah.
It's really not far.
Yeah.
And it used to be an institution for children of sorts. It has been there for years. It is the main activity is socio-political, but they also run a cultural center, and it is part of a series of reclaimed spaces in Venice, where there are lots of abandoned buildings. So there is actually a map of occupied houses and these sort of reclaimed spaces in Venice and Marghera and Padova. So that's a further connection, I guess, with Venice. And it is the idea of pretty much auto-producing the space that has been erased in, you know, dismantling of public spaces. Although I think that here there are a few public spaces still, but nevertheless. So that's maybe another connection that you can make, and I can give you some addresses.
Yeah.
In the Protest Lab Archive, I guess it is an ongoing archive, and it has different types of protests.
Yeah.
Some of them are very creative. I do like the video of Paloma Blanca, for instance, and I find it really, really, really funny. What other types of actions have been proposed as part of the Protest Lab?
I mean, I suppose the most, shall we say, oblique was an action where a group of people dressed in full Muslim costume, head to toe black with only the eyes showing. Because within the Russian culture, there's a certain sort of suicide bomber called Shahidi, who were used in Beslan, these women that strap the bombs to themselves under their clothes and blew themselves up. Because Lithuania is a monoculture, as is Poland, as is Russia, for that matter, you know, 99% of 40 million people in Poland are Polish. So all the people did in that action was walk in full,
the hijab.
A full hijab, the streets. There was no, to see what would happen. Of course, special security forces came to ask what they were doing, because they were seen as some perceived threat. But they weren't carrying any message. It was just about testing the limits of public perception and space in relation to difference. I think that's the most oblique event. There was a dog lovers event where everybody just brought their dogs to the space because, you know, within protest, there's always signs, honk your car horn if you support, you know, when you're people honk. Well, this was like, make your dog bark if you support Cinema Litva. So you know, there's a great deal of humour, like in Una Paloma Blanca, and, you know, it's not all so cut and dried. But basically, it's just making space for everybody to come and do something, you know, because the actual space is just vanishing. I mean, there's a deliberate reason for that, because under the Soviet, of course, there was compulsory membership of Komsomol, the Red Pioneers, the, you know, different sorts of unions. You had to participate. So people don't want to participate in things for a reason. But that has meant they've given up their democratic right or their democratic will, you see. So now they're just trying to produce some sort of space where people can gather together that doesn't cost money, because of course people go to concerts together, you go to the movies, you go to a basketball match, but that you're all paying somebody for that privilege. So it's sort of, you know, reinventing a free agora, for want of a better word, you know.
And I guess also from one of the videos, one thing that comes out is that it is not simply a matter of space, but of social practices and social relation.
Yeah.
So I wonder if these social relations were fragmented after, you know, this, let's call it, collective era after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when Lithuania became independent.
Yeah.
And if this is I don't like the word grassroots, but anyway, a grassroots reappropriation and creation of social relations against the fragmentation of the social fabric.
Despite Soviet culture being classless, it was very stratified, because people that belong to the same profession or the same sort of work all lived in similar districts. You know, if you worked for this factory or you were an engineer or you were an artist, you got given state housing in a certain area. And you got access to goods and access to travel and access to a foreign travelling passport according to your station. Now, of course, it was a reflection of labour, not necessarily connection, or, you know. But then again, it was very top to bottom, even though class wasn't one of the indicators. Now, some sort of class system, a topsy-turvy class system, has come about so that on the one hand, cultural workers have access to media, access to power, you know, to people in powerful position, but we get paid nothing. You know, we're very poor, so there are all sorts of strange.
So it is rich in cultural capital and symbolic capital,
absolutely.
And poor in economic capital.
So in the one sense, it is a grassroots movement for reinventing the ways that people can come together. On the other hand, it's a reminder that people used to be together much more in the past, and this wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because societal fragmentation is done deliberately by neoliberal government in bed with business, because they want to exploit people as singular consumers. And especially because nobody before 91 owned private property, and you didn't actually have personal space per se. So, of course, personal space and private property and ownership has become understandably very important to people. But on the other hand, that means people are out of the habit of getting together to make a voice on issues that are important. For instance, you know, there's a referendum on whether we join the EU, which happened, but the government just said we are now members of NATO. Now, NATO membership is not mandatory for a small country like Lithuania. I mean, the mentality is by belonging to NATO, it takes away the threat of the Russians rolling back, which is present in an older generation's mind, of course. So it's understandable, but you should probably ask the people, because that's a major, you know, sort of structure, a major conservative militaristic structure to be a member of without asking.
And I wonder if this, you know, in this shift from Soviet to post-Soviet, and this shift in the way that politics are made, if there was a juncture where artists could immediately intervene and in a way maybe even foresee new ways of making politics by other means. That's what it looks like.
I mean, the Siadis movement, which was the name of the movement which started the Singing Revolution, because, of course, Lithuania was the first Baltic state to break away, was actually based around Vilnius Art Academy and was based around a group of intellectuals, artists, composers. So they had a very active role. But there's a sense in which they were all nationalists and desperately conservative. And now, like Vytautas Landsbergis, who's the deputy speaker of the European Parliament, EU Parliament in Brussels, I mean, he's a Christian Democrat. And he belongs to the conservative bloc, which is the ironic thing. So you can actually be politicized or political and make a sort of art which borders on that territory, but it can actually be desperately conservative politics. So the differentiation between the political in terms of post-Sovietic space and dealing with political process and dealing with art and urbanist's practice is it's clearly liberal politics or left politics, and it's contemporary art with a contemporary art aesthetic. So that, because other sorts of political or politicized art go on in the country in a Sovietic main, and this is something different. And maybe this connects to the world of international art much more and can be understood in terms of other Western practices, and that's the difference.
There is something that you just said that I was wondering about watching some of the videos, in particular the ones about the graffiti in Rome, which is the issue of nationalism.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that there are two directions. And one is that there is a nationalist undercurrent in some of the works, but at the same time, it is erased by notions of deterritorialized Lithuania, of probably a Lithuania that is made of trajectories and it's made at an imaginary and symbolic level. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on this, also in relation to Europe. One of the things that the Minister for Culture was saying yesterday that I found very, very moving was the return to Europe. We are returning to Europe. And I find that moving, but at the same time quite puzzling, because I have no idea what Europe might be.
I mean, I think that one thing about moving to Europe, you could look at it in terms of family lines, for one. Because Lithuania has been a contested territory for 500 years, 500 years ago, the Lithuanian-Polish Grand Duchy was one of the most powerful crowns in Europe, as a matter of fact. And the Habsburgs happened to be marrying into it, as did the Hohenzollerns. But that was dismantled. I mean, think about the fact that in Lithuania you have Polish families, you have Lithuanian-German families in the section that's known as East Prussia. You have Lithuanian-Russian families. Now, during the Soviet era, of course, this famous slogan is Poland is another country. You could not go there at all. So rejoining Europe, in a sense, just means rejoining other parts of the world in which there were historical connections and connectivity and having the freedom to be there. I mean, before 1991, being in Venice in your own pavilion space, even though it's outside the Giardini, just didn't exist. A certain sort of artist would have been exhibited in the USSR pavilion. And of course, there's one famous Soviet sculptor who was actually Lithuanian, who was shown something like 13 times in that context. So rejoining Europe, in one sense, just means, for many people, rejoining family, being able to take a holiday, being able to, participate in very everyday sorts of things. It also means, of course, all sorts of conservative things about claiming culture. I mean, there's a whole set of Lithuanian emigre artists and cultural producers, like Levinas. Levinas never did any important work in Lithuania. He left in 1919 and had already made a choice. I mean, by 1939, he'd already lived in Paris for 20 years by choice, because that's where his work was based. That's where the great university was. That's where he was, felt connected. So to say that he's something else is something else. I think in a young country, and I would typify European Australia and European New Zealand as young as well, and Canada you have to develop some sort of national language. The new Lithuania is only 15 years old. And there's a sense in which contemporary art, which can be positive in a national sense, have some sort of nationalistic, transformative iconography, can perhaps send a message to power or to official culture that it can renovate itself. It doesn't have to look to stock standard monumental structures. The ironic thing is that in this project we have had an absolute battle with the Ministry of Culture, who of course comes and realizes we've really produced something which is going to be celebrated, so they have the opportunity to make a great speech. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the ambassador that spoke has been deliberately antagonistic or deliberately ambivalent towards the project, actually refusing to assist us because of a certain fear that we were going to shine a spotlight on a subject that could interrupt a set of negotiations that are going on between the Lithuanian and Italian governments to do with restitution. I mean, I think those are all good things, because it's allowing an artist to claim a style of nationalism that otherwise you wouldn't deal with. I mean, I think in more established countries, you can only be an iconoclast, but why not, an iconographer? I mean, I think it can be positive, and that's what this is about.
Yes, I do agree, and I find that it is probably a unique situation. Yeah. And it is also unique because evidently you have the means to speak the contemporary art language. Because I've seen lately in Sydney some Lithuanian artists coming from the academy in Vilnius who were absolutely conservative.
Absolutely,
And in the kind of modernist tradition, if you want. It was like the displaced modernist displaced from Paris into the provinces. Yeah. So it seems to me that there is a reinvention of language, artistic language and practices that goes together with the process, if you want, of nation building, if you want to call it that. I'm not really sure it is nation building, because anyway the borders are really fluctuating in a way, and I think this comes out quite well in the project, the idea that you have pigeons. I mean, how do you think borders when you are a pigeon? It would be quite an interesting...
And that's why pigeons, and that's why, because the pigeons are citizens of Villa Lituania, and Villa Lituania is just a conceptual territory that we're claiming for ourselves. So they don't actually have a nation, and they don't actually have all the issues to do with citizenship, except the one that we give them, and that's kind of interesting. In terms of a unique situation for nationalism, I think this is here when you can talk about Europes in the multiple, because there's a distinct Europe of Greece, Portugal, and Spain, only re-entered Europe themselves in 68, 73, and 76, so they're only 30 years old, and they are still having to come to grips with what being blocked from Europe proper by fascist regimes meant, And then, of course, there's the new Europe of the 15-year independent states. But I think this is interesting, north-south dichotomy if you place the Greece and Portugal and Spain in the south, and then there's this sort of east to west, dichotomy, which is kind of interesting, because you can find, if you go to Lisbon, for instance, Lisbon and Vilnius, for some reason, feel kind of the same, for many reasons, even though one's freezing cold and the food is bad, and one's beautiful and warm and the food is good. But there's a certain sort of minor Catholicism and all sorts of other things, a cultural interruption, which is really related. You can feel really comfortable there. It's like, oh, Vilnius of the south or Lisbon of the north.
That's very interesting, and I think also that it opens up questions about the definition of Europe, which seems to me that is largely defined as EU or the Eurozone in terms of money as well and so on. And I think that is the reason for this is also that the European Union is putting quite a lot of money into the making of Europe in a cultural sense, so that the notions of belonging are central to the cultural policies of the EU. The next year will be the year of intercultural dialogue and so on and so forth. But it is pretty much imagined from Brussels.
Yeah.
So projects like this do question this assumption of what Europe is, and in a way they do go against this governmental imaginary that is built around Europe. I'm not saying that it is a bad thing, but that the EU is trying to work on cultural citizenship, but it seems to me that produces projects that are very old Europe, in the Rumsfeld sense almost. Yeah. So that, we talk about migrants in Berlin, but then we leave out the states that are not into the EU as such.
Well, I think, if you look at a city like Glasgow, Glasgow, on the one hand, is incredibly Scottish, but on the other hand, because the other cities in Great Britain all look towards London as a capital, Glaswegian artist or intellectual would never suggest to look to London for anything, but point you directly to mainland Europe. And when you go to England itself, it's clear that London is the only European city within England. But that's even mediated because the majority of the immigrant populations are former colonial, you know, African, Indian, Pakistani, you know. But the minute you get on a train and go to Manchester and Liverpool, you encounter an old England, which is quite separate from the Euro view, which the Blairite government has, you know, perpetrated. I mean, it's quite nice to be in this in London because of its Eurocentricity. But then again, it's a misrepresentation of what the, you know, the rest of the British Isles is about.
Can I ask and I something specific about the project here, which is it has very different components. It has a fashion designer, it has a designer, video, evidently the archive, writing. How did you think this through?
This comes out of Nomeda and Gediminas, you know, having an idea of what it is they want to produce, but knowing, like any process-based artist or somebody that runs a studio, I mean, the extreme example is Jeff Koons as a sculptor. I mean, they know where their expertise lies and they concentrate their time on the things that they can do best, which is setting up an intellectual framework. I mean, the video is simply, I mean, they direct the video, they do a lot of the camera work themselves, but we have a director of photography who also does the edit, you know. It's just a matter of, I think, more standard procedural outsourcing. Though the overall artwork is somewhere in between the fashion, the design, the film, the architecture. Because one thing that is great is that there's a certain motif that runs through the whole work. And what they understand kind of well is that in the end, procedural-based art or political process-based art has to have an aesthetic outcome to be a real success in an art context. Because the projects are becoming really successful in a political context because, you know, the Save the Cinema has entered the legal framework now. It's being debated in courts, being debated in Parliament. But how can you articulate that visually, you know, as a visual outcome? Because otherwise it starts to lose its artness. And I think that that just furniture in the name of relational aesthetics, which is what, you know, the Jorge Pardo version is not enough. So you have to have, you know. And fashion is, of course, belongs to the everyday, and it belongs to people, and it sits on the body and becomes something of use. And so that's procedural in itself. And it also invites questions. So it invites a social interaction between the wearer and the person. And because generally that person will tell more about the overall project. And so there's, you know, a carry-on of the social within that engagement.
Okay, I think that this is enough. Do you want to add anything?
No, I think
maybe
one
other thing is that the relation between the two parts of the
exhibition. Because the Protest Lab archive or the Protest Lab is still active, it's still unfolding. I mean, there was a sense in which saying it's an old work or doesn't belong in Venice seemed to not make sense because it's unfolding in a similar way to the other work. And because both stories are about a building called Lithuania, Cinema Lithuva, Villa Lithuania, it's two different languages, obviously, there's a nice relationship And because both buildings are somehow representative buildings and represent a certain style of architecture of its day, you know, one is Soviet modernistic, one is neoclassicism. Of course, both Soviet modernism and neoclassicism have been thrown out in terms of the canon of architecture and the canon of good representative architecture. But there's something valuable in both of those architectures, both symbolically and as objects in and of themselves. So there's a lovely relationship there between the two. And it also lets the audience know that despite the Villa Lituania exhibition being Italian-specific and contextual and a new work, there's a real basis for the artist's practice. You know, it's not like they've done a Biennale-style show. This is actually what their whole oeuvre or their whole project is about. Yeah.
And how did you go about researching the different stories that appear about Villa Lituania? Well, people as
well. Yeah, well, there was the pinnacle figure is Kazis Lozoraitis, who tells the story of the house. I mean, by travelling to Rome and going to Mr. Lozoraitis and just asking, and then people presented themselves from him. There's also a Lithuanian art historian, Giedrė Jankevičiūtė, who's recently written a biography of Mrs. Lozoraitis, Kazis Lozoraitis' wife, who's a remarkable woman in her own right. So Giedrė Jankevičiūtė was able to then help pinpoint, you know. And because the Lithuanian community in Rome has already constituted itself around a certain some set of nodes, even during the USSR years, I mean, if you travel to those nodes in classic emigre or diasporic style, you can connect with everybody quite simply. So they are the Vatican Radio, the Collegium of Lithuanian Catholic Priests, the, you know what I mean, a certain set of bars, restaurants, districts, you know.
Diaspora style. I was pretty much thinking in terms of the Lithuanian traces in Rome. It seems to me that there is, from the work it comes out that there is a Lithuanian history in Rome itself, and I like the idea of traces, especially then when it's in the graffiti video, that becomes visually quite quite evident. Yes. And the other idea that was in my mind was the archive, not simply in literally, but in the building of the archive. So those are probably the things I will be writing about.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
My pleasure.